Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We for UNITY. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
That's right. That's right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host with Voices from the Battlefield. We are having some technical difficulties, so I don't know if you heard the intro music, which may mean that you can't hear me, but we'll know in a few minutes. So we have some special guests in the studio and on the phone, and we I'm going to jump into that in a minute, but I do want to make a couple of announcements because this is the place where you are going to hear from people on the battlefield, and the battlefield can be virtual, it can be actual, but it's all about democracy, it's all about justice, it's all about making a better world for everybody. This month, June, is Black Music Month, and Black music is the soundtrack for America, whether they admit it or not. And so Frankie Beverly, who is retiring, picked St. Louis as one of the places to stop for the farewell tour. And I'm going to tell y'all, St. Louis gave him a beautiful farewell. It was a full house. They came in a sea of white because that's what Frankie likes folks to wear. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful concert. And so he also brought the OJs and the Whispers. So it was a dynamite performance. So we're going to make some more announcements about Black music at the end. But also I want to say at this very time of the show, Janice Mensa is on trial, and that's down at the courthouse, municipal courthouse. And if you remember, they were formerly vice president of the jail oversight committee and was assaulted by some of the guards in the committee, I mean in the jail, and so she's on trial. So that's today, and you know, hopefully people can go there as they're listening on their car radio because she needs our support. They need our support. And so we'll we report next week what happened, but you know, you could be in the courtroom and find out for yourself. Janice Mensa on trial for being assaulted by guards at the jail, and we'll see how that all works out. I want to be facetious and say our tax dollars at work, because it's the city councilor's office who is, you know, prosecuting. So that's our tax dollars, y'all. So just know that. Let me just say that the opinions expressed on Black Radio Hall of Fame are those of the program host and not necessarily those of Harris Stowe State University or BRF Radio. So this is an important show, I think, for a number of us, because what we've seen around the genocide in Gaza is the headlines are fading and people are trying to figure out, well, what's going on now. A lot of the most visible protests were on campuses across the country. Well, the semester ended, and so therefore a number of those protests ended. And I think the universities love when those incidents happen like that. You know, if it happens just before spring break or winter break, well, they know, okay, this too shall pass, and then, you know, we'll go on to something else. So we don't see a whole lot going on. But again, that doesn't mean that things are not happening in Gaza, because genocide still is happening in Gaza. So we have two biological sisters here in the studio, Alam, Jabber, and Nesreen. And on the phone we have Steve Tamari, and if that last name sounds familiar, we know that, you remember that we had his partner and co-conspirator, Sandra here earlier, with Anna Balser to talk about this issue. And so welcome Alam and Nesreen and Steve to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So I'm not sure, and I might need Bernie to make sure that we could hear Steve, who's on the phone, through the system, because we're going to need him to start us off, because one of the questions is always, what is the history of Zionism? We know that it didn't start October 7th. It's long and torturous, much to the demise of the Palestinian people. And so if you would, Steve, start us out by talking about Zionism as it relates to the Palestinian land. And it's, you know, I know this is not a quickie kind of explanation, because it's very long and people, often say, well, it's so complicated, we'll never get to a solution, which is not true, because in many ways it's quite simple. So, can you answer for us, whether or not, okay. So we, yes, we can. I think we can. We can hear you in the studio. I just want to make sure that we can hear you on the air. So Bernie Hayes might have to come back in and tell us that that's okay. But tell us a bit about how we got to this place. And then I'm going to ask you more, you all more specific questions about the role of Hamas now. And there's been questions about what happened to the PLO and what is the governance structure. And we'll get into that. But first, if we talk about the history, then we know where all this flows. So.
Well, thank you so much. It's really an honor to be talking to you, Jamala Rogers. You know, I know we live in some ways in a youth-centered society, and I think in some ways that's good at this time, but I think it's always important to remember our elders, I'm not young myself, but people like yourself who have, shown us the path towards, as you said, collective liberation. And I think, first of all, it's important to understand, and I think young people today understand this, that the question of Palestine is not separate from, liberation struggles in this country and around the world. One thing I thought of, a way of addressing this, is to start with what the conflict, or what the situation going on in Gaza now is not. And I think that will help break down some of the myths that people tend to repeat. So it's not an Arab-Israeli conflict. It's not a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It's not an Arab-Jewish conflict. It's not a Jewish-Muslim conflict. I think the best way of understanding what's happening in Palestine today and what's been happening over the last, better part of the last century, is that a war on Palestine. And that happens to be the title, part of the title of my favorite book on the topic, introductory book on the topic, which is Rashid Halabi's The War on Palestine. It's a war on Palestine as a whole because there's a colonial context here. The British colonized this area in the early 20th century, and they encouraged the settlement of Jews from Europe who were fleeing massacres and eventually genocide there, to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And that's basically what Zionism is. The movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine. The irony, or I don't know if it's an irony or the tragedy, is that the British colonial forces and other forces at the time were trying to solve a European problem, which is Christian European anti-Semitism, on the backs of a population, on the backs of Palestinians, Muslims, Christians, and actually Palestinian Jews, who had nothing to do with that history in Europe, right? But this was a way of the colonial forces and the powers at the time to address a problem of their own. And the idea was to create an exclusivist Jewish state, a state where Jews would be the majority and would be, in theory, protected from the violence and oppression that they had faced in. Problem was that there was a large non-Jewish indigenous population in Palestine, right? Majority Muslim, but also including indigenous Jews and Christians as well. The only way to deal with that, to have a majority Jewish state with certain privileges for the Jewish population, was to either get rid of the Palestinian people or treat them as second-class citizens or as people under military occupation. And so I like folks to think about this as a war on Palestine and to understand that Palestine is a unit, is a whole. And that Palestine is within what is today Israel, within the 1948 borders of Israel. Palestinians who are in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Palestinians in Gaza are all under the same racist apartheid system, right? The levels of discrimination and apartheid and outright expulsion and genocide vary, right, from one zone to the other. Gaza happens to be that zone, which is basically the Israelis and Zionism wants to eliminate, in my mind, the population there, either push them out or make Gaza unlivable as part of a 100 years war, basically, on Palestine as a whole.
That's helpful, Steve. And one of the things when you were talking, I thought about was, and I know this postcard has to be at least 20 years old, but there was a postcard that showed green of Palestinian land, and over time, there's maybe was three maps, mm-hmm. and it showed the disappearing lands. And I think that, okay, this is 20 years old, and I kept asking people, when are we going to get an update? Because if this is the trajectory, or the trends, I don't see where there's going to be any land left. So our people. And to the point that you made about the goal is to push people out, eliminate them any way they can. We see that unfolding in front of our very eyes with this whole thing. So in some cases, people want to blame Hamas for the attack, but, part of this is defending your land, and it's about self-determination. So I think it's appropriate to say war on Palestine, because it's so many other entities that are helping the Zionists do what they do, including, this government here, the U.S., who sends pretty close to $5 billion over there for military aid, and then you have all the other collaborators. So it really isn't just, as you said, what it's not, and that particular land is very strategic, so people ought to know wherever there's big fights, it's about land and resources and power, and so it has nothing to do with what is always being projected. But you also talked about the role of young people, and I kept looking at and participating in some cases in what was going on locally and nationally about young people and how they were standing up, and not just Palestinian students and Palestinian American students, but you know, this touched a nerve for a lot of folks. And so the guests in the studio today have been part of some of those protests, and I know you were an observer because you're a professor. I had Walter Johnson here in the studio some weeks ago, who is a professor at Harvard, and so happens that he is the advisor for the Palestinian support group. And so, you know, my question to him was, the folks who are open about their viewpoints, what kind of targets did they become? And for yourself, who's been, you know, supporting students in this particular issue, what that's been like. So I want all three of you all to speak to that. And then I have a question about what we think came out of those protests. So we can start with
that. You know, I think that one, I don't think as a student we've quite faced here at St. Louis, you know, St. Louis University, as a PhD student, I haven't quite faced like the repercussions maybe of these actions. I haven't gone out to the workforce, and you know, SLU has a much different energy than WashU does. You know, the way we handled our protests, the way our president handled our protests, wasn't met with the level of violence, you know, that WashU meets our students with. So, you know, it's difficult to kind of speak to, like, how this is going to affect where, you know, I'll be able to find a job. But, you know, I was talking to some of my professors about this, because it is a fear, you know, and one of them said, and I love her, she's a badass, you don't want to work somewhere that doesn't want your kind of activism. You don't want to teach somewhere that doesn't allow you to talk about these things, to educate, you know, students. And they actually, that helped facilitate me teaching an Arab American lit class next semester, like kind of as soon as possible, so that we can get to these subjects, you know. And almost all of the books I'm talking about are written by Palestinian writers. So, you know, that's the difference between SLU and WashU, at least.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think we saw that in real time. And for a long time, the barricade stayed up at Washington U so that you...
They're still there.
Yeah.
All around the campus.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and I always tell people, they want the little flimsy plastic orange temporary ones. Oh. These are metal fences that have an additional height added to it so that you can't not scale them easily.
Yeah.
So the message is quite clear.
Funding, right? Great use of the funding.
Right, you know, right. Yeah,
you know?
your big old...
Yeah, we'd love to see a big fence.
Yeah. And so, Nesrin, what about you? What was the activism like where you were, and what were the repercussions?
So I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of North Dakota, and my biggest... how to say, like, co-conspirator there was an Ashkenazi Jewish man from the biology department, a professor there. Bob, if you're listening to this, thank you so much. I love you so much. and he and I went to the president of the university's office, and we had a conversation around Zionism, the differences between Zionism and Judaism. It was at the time where universities were sending out messages condemning the so-called terrorist organization Hamas, and really like replicating that rhetoric from Congress of you know, this rise of anti-Semitism and fear for like our Jewish members of the community, which is fair and valid and beautiful. We want everybody to be safe, but was completely ignoring the Arabs and the Muslims who are also impacted by this genocide in very different ways. Some overlap, but also different ways. So I was met with some niceness. The president heard me, but I was...
He listened.
Yes.
But hope he heard you.
I appreciate the distinction.
I he even met with you, because I tried.
But it's all nice, though, right? It's all nice. It just and it ends there. There was no, I asked for action. There was no,
follow up,
mm-hmm. No commitment. I, several times, as a matter of fact. And then within my own department, I was siloed. We have a, you know, departmental listserv, and so I think it was like October 12th or something that I sent out an email giving a history and sharing my perspective. And I'll be quite frank, I am a complete supporter of armed resistance for Indigenous people. It's supported by international law, and that's where I stand, and I'm unapologetic in that stance. And after that, and then I sent
a silence after that.
It was. I had like two faculty members reach out to me individually and not, again, in the listserv, just to me personally. And I had a couple of peers who reached out to me as well. And then I sent out a similar email to every dean and every department head of the university. I received nothing from that. And then after that, I was blocked from sending emails out to the listserv. Mm. Yeah.
Not surprising.
Not surprising at all. Yeah. Not surprising at all. And, you know, I'm in counseling psychology, and we have a supposedly deep focus on social justice. And even the head of the DEI was once my mentor, and, you know, we asked, Bob and I asked him if we could host a panel, and honestly just ignored us and never got back to us. And so people who I had a really good working relationship with, it all just sort of dissipated.
Mm.
And
yeah. So when the rubber really meets the road, people like fled, you know, like roaches in the light. You know, it's really kind of sad, but at the same time, you get to see who your real, who's going to really stand with you in times of need. And so for you, Steve, over there across the river, what was that like for students to be participating in protests and making demands of the administration there?
Well, it wasn't easy, and I was actually surprised by it, but when the students first got organized, and it was primarily the Muslim Students Association, and then we had an Arab club, and eventually we revived a Students for Justice in Palestine group. I had an encounter with an important colleague, I guess, who was filming the students as they were gathering in the quad at the center of the university. And the students were uncomfortable with that. I asked them to stop filming just for the sake of the students. And we got into a big, debate about that. He was telling me this is a free country. I can do whatever I want. So there was that kind of thing. I gave a talk in early November or late October. And, of course, I had to be countered by a talk by an Israeli. We were in the middle of a genocide. And, I mean, are there two sides to a genocide? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
But that was one of those CYA moments for the university.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
That was a CYA moment for the university to say that, we gave platform to both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then that didn't go very well, so they invited a scholar, two scholars actually, from UCLA to speak, and a group of Zionist faculty pressured the administration to disinvite them because one of them was accused of being an anti-Semite when there's no foundation for this at all, just because they were perhaps a little critical of Israel. I mean, this is a really important thing, the confusion between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So anti-Semitism is hatred of the Jews as Jews, right? And that's a thing, and it's a bad thing, and it exists, you know, and it led to the Holocaust, right? But anti-Zionism has nothing to do with one's Jewish identity. There are plenty of Jews who are also anti-Zionist. They simply are opposed to the idea of an exclusivist, you know, apartheid state that has dispossessed, you know, the indigenous population of Palestine and is now waging a war of annihilation, really, against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
But we still live in this world, and the administration of my university operates in this way, in which anything that, anything that's critical of Israel is dubbed anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. When, and that's a very, you know, being accused as being an anti-Semite is a very scary thing, right? And, you know, it can destroy careers. It can, and of course it can lead to a, you know, disinvitation as it did at my university. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I would say is that it was the students who really, kept things going, and I think this generation understands the connections between people who are struggling for liberation across, you know, race and ethnicity and immigrant status and, you know, sexual orientation, gender. There's a sense of the collective in this generation that I don't remember seeing, you know, over a couple decades of teaching. And I'm in that way, I'm very hopeful about what's been happening.
Yeah. I was too, because it wasn't just Palestinian students that were out there. It was a mass of folks out there who were taking stands against particularly the universities and the U.S. government. And so this issue of when you talk about Palestine, that you automatically get branded as being anti-Zionist. I saw that play out in campuses. Even now, there's these skirmishes that that are being publicized where, it looks like it's, you know, the Jewish students against the Palestinians. And really, that's not it at all. So I know you wanted to jump in.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to preface a little bit. So I'm sorry. You know, a PhD student in the English department at St. Louis University. I wanted to add a little bit about my sister, or what she was saying about her university. Mm-hmm. While we did not get this sort of level of violence that WashU displayed towards her students, we were still met with an insane amount of silence and inaction. And I tried to meet the president's office, and I met with somebody in the office, was not met with by the president at all. So I just wanted to say that, because I'm not over here like clapping my hands for SLU or for any university in this United States.
Well, some have started to divest.
Sure,
and I
sure.
think that's commendable.
Also, yeah.
And we have to honor, I think, also the ways in which we are seeing growth in this mm-hmm. country. I know it's in some ways outweighed by someone on.
But I was going to ask about that, because that was one of the main demands. The best, mm-hmm. and of course that's the page taken out of the anti-apartheid movement,
exactly.
which was very successful in exactly. helping to bring down that
for sure.
that government. But what I noticed, you all, was that they had also rewrote how they were dealing with their investments.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh man, they said we ain't gonna do that again. We got caught with our heads, our pants down, but not this time. And so then they had what they would call the legitimate reason why we can't divest, is because now it's in the hands of these folks, and that's separate from the universe. I mean, I saw all kind of things. I'm like, wait, they really were prepared for this whole demand, and now they're saying, oh, we can't do anything because of X, Y, and Z.
Yes.
So what about the campuses that you all are on? Was there an opening for them to respond to divesting, or was that an issue, like, this is a no issue for us because we have nothing to do with the investments?
I'm a part of Occupy SLU and helped to organize some of the protests at St. Louis University, and I don't think anybody was received with, I don't think the president's office even approached that conversation at all. I don't think they uttered the word divestment one single time, even though it was a part of every single one of our demands every single time, you know. And kind of connecting back to what Steve was saying, you know, like this, like, criticism of Israel and this like conflation, you know, this dangerous conflation of like criticism of Israel with now anti-Semitism, and the university is like using this to silence students. So now it's like, it's beyond even criticizing Israel. Now it's like, if I support, you know, Palestine or Palestinian liberation or liberation for the Congo, for Sudan, for Puerto Rico, for Hawaii, for anywhere. You know, like, there's this movement, this liberation movement that's being stifled and now being connected to anti-Semitism, you know? And I know my sister wanted to speak on that a little bit too, in terms of, like, you know, the conflation of anti-Semitism, Judaism, this conversation about religion and how it's honestly silencing and stifling, you know, spaces that are meant to be,
absolutely,
you know, places where you pursue truth, quote unquote. Mm-hmm.
Especially on campuses where there's supposed to be the flowering of different views and democracy at its highest and all that other good stuff.
And I think Steve did touch on that a bit too, but I think another area where campuses are really doing a disservice is we really focus a lot on diversity, and we think of diversity in terms of, like, diversity of bodies, diversity of skin color, without ever really talking about and honing in on diversity of thought, right? And having a place where people can have different ideas and can discuss openly without threat of censorship. Or several students, I know at Columbia, for example, and also the University of Chicago, who were, like, expelled or suspended or revoked, their degrees were revoked. Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's really important to say, too, just to hone back in a little bit on Zionism and Judaism, you know, the issue of Palestine, as Steve said, is an issue of colonialism and indigeneity, right? And it's Zionist settler colonialism specifically. What makes it Zionist is that it calls for a Jewish ethnostate. And with that, you know, Zionism is co-opting Judaism, right? It's calling for a Jewish ethnostate. It's guising itself within the folds of Judaism. But Zionism is not woven into or actually really connected to Judaism as a religion. It is white supremacy. It's settler colonialism with, you know, hiding behind Judaism, right? And so I just really want to acknowledge that. Yeah. And when you talk about, you know, anti-Semitism, on a political level, they're conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. It's great to be an anti-Zionist. It's horrifying to be anti-Semitic.
And
right?
Also, like, who are the Semites? You know, as a PhD student in English, you know, the use of language, the manipulation of language, and, you know, it's horrendous, and it's so, like, the propaganda is just, like, right in your face, you know what I mean? And it's so obvious at this point, I mean, at least for
many of us.
For many of us, you know, but, like, Arabs are Semites too, you know what I mean? So when you use the term anti-Semitic and you erase our presence in that word, you know, in that identity, you know, that's what it is. I'm sorry. You're erasing our identity too, you know, and you're co-opting a word or phrase or identity, language that, I don't know, is being used to, like, manipulate.
And Alam, I think that's a very important point to continue to lift up, because those of us in the West don't really have a grasp of our own history in this country, let alone somebody else's. Mm-hmm. So when somebody would say anti-Semitic, folks now automatically think anti-Jewish when it's about the peoples of that region.
Right.
And so, again, that's why a discussion about this is so important. And I think lifting up the fact that there are Jewish people who are anti-Zionist, not anti-Semitic, because that would be like they against themselves, but anti-Zionist. And so this keeps playing out again and again, and that's why I want my listeners to be very clear. If you take a stand for Palestine, for Palestinian self-determination, self-determination, for liberation, that does not make you anti-Semite. No. That does not mean you're anti-Jewish. And I'm going to have to drum that in again and again, because we have so many examples of the mainstream media, as you say, conflating that. At Mokabee's coffee shop, somebody made a sign and put it on the wall that says, I learned about Palestine from Hetty. And most people don't know Hetty Epstein was, like, one of the Jewish people. In fact, she was a Holocaust victim who, to her dying days, and she lived to be 90-something years old, was definitely anti Zionist.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Not anti-Jewish, anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. And so it's been people like her that have made it clear, but those voices don't get the kind of volume and amplification that we would see. And so then the dominant narrative is always, if you speak against a Jewish person, it's going to be that you are anti-Semitic.
I think the you hit it on the head with that, the narrative. I think, you know, people on the left, you know, kind of need to reclaim the narrative and do the, if you're going to conflate these terms like anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and whatever, then we need to start, you know, working towards, okay, you know, Zionism is white supremacy. Nail that into your heads. You know, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Right,
that's what it is. And that's what I'm going to keep saying and I'm going to keep talking about, because that is what it is.
Right.
So it's a part of it is just like, you know, like I took an anti-fascist course with Dr. Rachel Greenwald Smith at St. Louis University. She's my hero. I love her. But we talked about the use of these fascistic means, right? You know, Israel is a fascist nation, implementing fascist ideologies and
so is the United States, which supports Israel politically and materialistically.
Exactly. And so how do we combat that? And a part of that is reclaiming the narrative and
teasing out that language.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Teasing out that language. Like, we need to stop using the term anti-Semitic and replace it with anti-Jewish. And be very clear on what this language means, right? Because the way we use language, it influences the way that we think. It's how we, you know, communicate, how we conceptualize the world. And so the language is remarkably important. And using this term of anti-Semitic to describe only Jewish people too, I think, is a part of this, that and also conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism is a part of this movement to create indigenous erasure, right? Like, Dr. Laura Sheehy, who's my hero in the psychology world, talks a lot about, you know, the colonial settler attempts to claim indigeneity to the land through the ethnic erasure of the indigenous, and part of the ethnic erasure is obviously through the means of genocide and apartheid and occupation and just ultimate destruction, and it's also through the language.
And I think the part about the erasure that's being talked about and how that's very much connected to white supremacy and colonialism, I mean, we've seen that in this country with the indigenous people, even of people of African descent. I mean, you know, our history all of a sudden, you know, is invalid. You know, it's just like it just repeats itself. And so I think for those in this country, we should be able to relate to the fact that that's exactly what's going on.
The same people that don't want to talk about what's happening in Palestine, the same people that want to eradicate critical race theory from our classrooms.
Exactly. No, no,
don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
Right. So if you just joined us, you have stepped into a discussion about why we need to be more informed about what's going on in Palestine, and why then hopefully you'll be more supportive. But I had with us talking about this issue Alam Jaber and Nesrin, her sister, as well as Steve Tamari. And Steve, we have you on the phone, so we don't want to act like you're not a part of this discussion. The other question that comes up in our spaces, the spaces that I'm in, is like, well, Palestine is a nation, a country, or whatever. Well, what's the governance? Who's running the show? And that's when we begin to talk about Hamas, Hezbollah, and some of these other. And what happened to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO? Mm-hmm. So those are the questions that normally gets, you know, submerged in mainstream media, because they want you to think that there is an ungovernable space over there, that the folks don't know what the hell they're doing, and they just throwing rocks at stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, the images are just, you know, pretty self-explanatory if you don't know the backstory. So let's talk a little bit about what's the governance there, and after that, I really want us to talk about what are the demands of the Palestinian people, because I think that's the thing that gets confused. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say, well, we're for, you know, a two-state thing, you know, for the no, we're talking about like the land and we get to determine who's going to stay here. Mm-hmm. So just a little bit about maybe even if there's a range of views, I definitely want to end with that. But can we talk about governance? What is the governance structure like? And I know, Steve, you know, all of that has been under attack forever. And so for them not to have anything, I wouldn't be surprised, but, you know, you have to have some amount of governance there. So what does it look like for who's taking care of the folks over there, who's providing goods and services, who's making sure that, you know, there's some social and political structure?
So one of the big challenges for Palestinians is that we are divided, even in the region itself. So there are about 20% of the population of Israel, as it is today, are Palestinians. And they have passports, they can vote in elections, although there are limitations that Jewish Israelis get. I mean, there are privileges that Jewish Israelis get that don't apply to the Palestinian population. Access to land is one. Mm-hmm. The land of Israel is held at some level in perpetuity for the Jewish people. So the non-Jewish, the Palestinian population, which is mostly Muslim and Christian, and there are some other religious communities and ethnic communities involved, they're basically second-class citizens within Israel. Mm-hmm. Then there are those who are under occupation in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, although it gets complicated, especially in Jerusalem, and then Gaza as well. So the PLO was the revolutionary movement of the 1960s and 1970s. They were known in the West and among Israelis as the terrorists of the time, right? In the 1990s, the leadership, so we have our problems, like internally. I don't want to pretend otherwise. There are internal Palestinian issues at play here. The leadership of the PLO basically decided to succumb to American and Israeli pressure to give up claims to the whole of Palestine in return for basically crumbs, basically a Bantustan type of arrangement with Palestinian Authority, like a police force that could take care of traffic, trash collection, education. What used to be the PLO is known today as the Palestinian Authority, and it operates in parts of the West Bank. But it's basically, in the view of many people, it's doing the work of Israel and the U.S. Mm-hmm. to manage the population. That's where most of the funds get. That's where people get, it has support because people get salaries through that government.
I'm glad you're making that distinction. I think this is very illuminating, really.
Yeah, the PLO is basically not at all what, you know, some of us might remember it to be.
And when you said that was my first introduction to Palestine as a black student was the PLO. Over the years, as you're saying, they were weakened, and I'm sure that was a targeted effort.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Oslo Accords were the death knell to the PLO. They basically agreed to all kinds of concessions without any guarantee that those would happen, because they don't have the U.S. behind them. The Soviet Union was no longer, there was nowhere behind them. They agreed to certain concessions in return for others that were never fulfilled. And this is, by the way, this is not a, there's a lot of people who talk about Netanyahu as the problem. I think that's what a lot of liberal Zionists are blaming everything on, Netanyahu.
Well, he is a problem. He is.
But he is also a manifestation of this. Yeah. It's the logical conclusion of this idea that this space has to be, majority Jewish and not inclusive of the indigenous population, which is, if you take all those areas together, they're about half and half now, Jews and non-Jews. So one solution to that is to get rid of all the people. Anyway, as let me go back to governance, right? So that's the situation in the West Bank. The PA, the former PLO, really has no power at all. It has a police force. It cracks down on Palestinian dissidents. And it, and it can't stop Israel when Israel intervenes or, invades places like Ramallah or like the other towns that are supposed to be under the authority of the PA. And right now, we talk a lot about Gaza, but right now is the toughest time for the West Bankers to, at least in recent memory. People are being rounded up by the hundreds, being killed, unarmed civilians being killed. There is resistance in some of the towns, and the Israeli military is coming down hard. And because of this right-wing government that you have under Netanyahu, there's more and more effort to take over land for settlements. In the Gaza Strip, the presiding authority is Hamas. Hamas is basically what the PLO was 50 years ago, or whatever, 30, in the 60s. Hamas has not given up weapons or armed resistance, right? They have not succumbed to the kind of surrender that the PLO did. Palestinians will always resist, right? This kind of oppression. Gaza, there's so many stories here, but the Gaza was under a complete siege for 15 years before October 7th. And the siege was getting tougher and tougher, right? And Israel was reaching out to other Arab countries were about to make arrangements with Israel. Hamas was being squeezed. And it's not surprising that they rose up. It should not be a surprise. What else do you think Palestinians are going to do, right? They're being besieged. They're surrounded on all sides. They get bombed. There was a series of, shorter wars, but, destructive wars during the last 15 years in addition to the siege. So they rose up, and the Israeli intelligence, they weren't watching or something. And people just basically broke out of this jail that Gaza had become, this open-air prison. We don't know exactly, by the way, what happened on that day. Israel will not let anybody else in to investigate. We know that babies were not beheaded, as the president, of the United States repeated on several occasions.
Right.
And that story was retracted as well.
So, it was obviously, it was bloody, but that's what war is. That's war.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
This is not a war on Hamas, right? This is not an Israel-Hamas war. This is an Israeli war on Palestinians. Again. Going counter to all. All the news networks have this Israel-Hamas war. Israel-Hamas war. Israel-Hamas is the armed group, but, it's a genocide. Most of the people who are being killed are, I think we're close to 40,000 now. At least a third of them children. All the universities destroyed, hospitals destroyed. Now, here, Hamas is in control of the government, but Palestinians in Gaza especially, but Palestinians elsewhere as well, depend on the UN and, basically handouts. And then I didn't even address Palestinians in refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon.
Yes.
Each of those situations is different. So Palestinians are fragmented and they have no control over their future.
And I know for sure those of us of African descent in this country understand that kind of division, that kind of divide and conquer, because now that we're having a serious conversation about reparations, you see a range of viewpoints, and so and some of that has definitely been stoked by white supremacists, like you don't really need it, we're taking care of you. I mean, it's so colonial in nature. But yeah, I think when we look at the assault socially, culturally, politically, militarily on the Palestinian people over, you know, decades and decades, I think for Nesreen, you talking about psychology.
Yeah.
What is the impact of that on people's psyche, the trauma that's intergenerational that also is going to lend itself to difficulties and challenges when you talk about a state? Like who's got the mental capacity, who's got the sanity to begin thinking long range about mm-hmm. what this new Palestinian state is going to look like?
Yeah. Well, I want to preface by saying, too, that I am Lebanese American, and as a non-Palestinian, I don't think it's my place to say, like, what the Palestinian state will look like. I have my opinions. I believe in a one-state solution, but it's not my place to dictate anything.
Yeah, I'm not even asking you about that, but more like, what is the psychology of trying to come together to think mm-hmm. about what that could look like?
Yeah. Well, my mind goes in a few different places. I want to say, well, you mentioned like intergenerational trauma, and you know, the trauma is ongoing, right? So you're constantly experiencing trauma. There's a lot of the conversations in the psychology space, those that at least are open enough to having these conversations about Palestine, is that you can't heal from this, right? You can't heal as it is ongoing. And when it comes to sanity and insanity, I think anybody who is affected by this genocide, by this destruction, like that's happening now, and also feels the cumulative stress and trauma of it for the last 100+ years, like to be able to feel it shows that you are sane. Mm-hmm. It shows that you are connected with your own humanity. Yeah. And I would actually encourage people to, you know, be able to maintain their emotionality and their affect. Do not normalize this brutality. Don't get used to it.
Yeah.
And I think
absolutely.
That, you know, we often have times have these conversations, oh, you have to be rational and objective and logical. And it completely negates the compassion and the humanity and the emotion of the human experience. And so to be a so-called functional human being in today's society, I think that you're going to constantly be at odds with the social structure. You're going to feel the impacts of these confluences of oppression and privilege. And just to be able to be honest about that, be emotional about that, be compassionate with it. And I mean, what it does to the psyche, I think as we can see right now, people, Palestinian people, Lebanese, Yemeni, people all over the world, Iraqi, like Syrian, Iranian, like, that's just in the Middle East, right? But we can talk about people who are resisting all over the world. Look at Haiti. Mm. Look at Tigray. Like, look at, you know, there's so many examples. But what we've seen in the
Congo.
And Sudan and Congo, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. People are resisting, right? Like this, what is it doing to the psyche right now? I think you're seeing like this upsurge in resistance, mm-hmm. right? And resilience.
It's like Nesreen, like yes with you, but also an upsurge in
repression,
colonial, exactly, repression mm-hmm. and destruction
yes.
and violence. You know, what's happening in the Congo is not separated from what's happening in Palestine, from what's happening in Haiti, from what's happening in here in the United States, and what's happening in Puerto Rico and all across the world. I think there's something psychologically happening in terms of like an awareness that people are understanding our struggles are truly connected,
mm-hmm.
but also an awareness that the colonial powers are, I mean, they're using every possible means, psychological means, emotional
Absolutely.
Means, educationally, militarily, financially, economically, you know, whatever, every possible way to suppress and harm, and continue their imperialist and colonial, systems and
yeah.
that have been put in place for.
I really appreciated the point about not getting numb to what's happening, and that any resistance shows that people are alive and they understand that oppression.
Yes.
And so every time I see the images of young people throwing rocks at a U.S. produced tank, and folks are like, that's ridiculous. I'm thinking they're alive and they understand what's going on with their own liberation. And so whatever means they have, that is the gesture of resistance. And so it always makes me feel good. The image itself looks ridiculous because it's lopsided, but it just means that I know what's happening, and all I have is this rock, but I'm going to show you that I'm still alive, and I'm going to resist.
And I want to add to that, if I may. It's not to say that people aren't exhausted. People are exhausted. They are distraught. Like, those who are in the midst of it, and those of us who are here living in our comforts that are literally paid for by their blood, right? Like, and with that exhaustion also is resistance, and what perpetuates that ability to resist is being in community with one another, truly being in community with one another, solidarity, and not only knowing that our struggles are interconnected, but feeling that, feeling with each other. People don't understand. In psychology, you know, you can change your mindset as much as you want, but how do I say this? When you're working with clients, you can talk about thoughts, and that can be helpful, but change comes from the emotion, right? When people feel that something is wrong, that is when they're truly motivated to change. And so we have this tendency in this colonial society, this Western, Eurocentric, ideological society, that everything is supposed to be cognitive, everything is supposed to be rational. That is utter bullshit. And that is usually, I'm sorry, that is used to numb people and to, you know, strip them of their power, and our power truly is with our affect, our emotion. That is what motivates us.
Yeah. So in our last few minutes, and Bob Hansman, who is the host for the 2 o'clock hour, has graciously given us some extra time because we were like fumbling and stumbling here technologically. And so we do want to end with, what is the demands of the Palestinian people, as diverse as that might be? What are the options that people are looking at so that it helps us in the West understand, okay, that's something I can support, or that's something I can support, or that's something that they have a right to? What is the range of demands about what governance is going to look like in Palestine? Should these folks stop their genocide? Which, that, you know, is also a big question, because I keep thinking, well, it's so lopsided. And I want people to understand this, even as much as you hear about the so-called terrorism of the Palestinian people, and they will show, you know, the bloody aftermath after a bomb. But the numbers don't add up, y'all. They just don't, in terms of how many Palestinians have been, you know, killed. So, even this, since October 7th, I mean, you know, Steve pointed out 40,000, and that's the dead, and children, and women. That's not even the folks that have been injured or displaced. And so,
and that doesn't count those who are still under the rubble, and that doesn't take into consideration the thousands of Palestinians held hostage in Israeli detention centers, including children.
Yeah. So these are the things that we don't get enough of in terms of balancing out what the real situation is. So let's talk about, in these last few minutes, what are Palestinians asking for? And it may not be one thing, because I don't see how it could be one thing. So, Steve, you want to lead us off with that?
Yeah, well, actually, it is one thing right now. It's ceasefire, right?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Everybody wants an end to this genocide.
Yeah.
And beginning with a permanent ceasefire, right? And the allowance, you know, and everything that that's required to allow food and medical supplies in to save those that are are still alive, right? And that's hard enough. I mean, we've been asking for that for, what is it now, six months? I can't even, October through, almost the beginning of
almost
July.
9 months.
Well, there's a lot that will go into reclaiming or rebuilding or whatever it is, whatever's left of Gaza. Mm. But, broader than that, people, Palestinians are not talking about a state or two states or any other solution right now. I mean, there are, people have their ideas, but the situation is so dire that I think the main demands of Palestinians are three, and these are the three demands that the boycott movement is organized around. And I think everybody can agree on these. One is equality for citizens, for Palestinian citizens inside Israel. Equality, I mean, that's really what is guaranteed, who it's aimed at, but basically equality, right? Political, the people of the land, Jews and non-Jews. The second is the end of military occupation, especially, particularly in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza. And third is the right to return for Palestinians who have been exiled from their homes, either in other countries or, you know, 80% of people in Gaza are refugees from other parts of what became Israel. I don't think anybody believes, even Israeli, many Israeli commentators don't believe that a two-state solution is a reality, even though that's what the official, I mean, I think even Netanyahu has denied any support for that. And then critics of Netanyahu also point out that the Israeli rule over the West Bank in particular is so entrenched that there's no way to disentangle, you know, Palestinians from Israelis if that were the idea. That is the official position of the PA and of the U.S. government and of the European countries, but it's kind of a nonsense issue. Palestinian claims are very simple. The right to be, to determine their future, you know, to live in a democratic state. The right to, you know, not be under military rule or, you know, basically foreign occupation. And the right to return to their homes or at least to receive some kind of compensation. There's no even, not even a recognition in this country, not to mention Israel, that Palestinians were ethnically cleansed, if you use that term, from their, like my father's family and my father, from their, you know, historic homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's pretty, I mean, again, like you said at the start, it's not that complicated. It's just bloody, you know.
Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm.
It's a war of, you know, it's an indigenous war against what started out as a colonial occupation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do believe that Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and non-Jews can live, you know, together in peace. They did that as Jews and Muslims and Christians did that for centuries under Islamic law, mm-hmm. Islamic rule.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be either or, you know, like a total Jewish state or a small Jewish state or a little, it could just, you know, I mean, what we all want
mm-hmm.
is equality and freedom. And I don't believe that an ethno state, an ethno religious state like Israel can you know, is sustainable on the long term. It's always going to be, you know, it's always going to be exclusivist and turned in on its side and depend on violence to preserve itself.
Right, right. And I see Alam and Nesreen nodding their heads, but I wanted to ask, is there any other things that you all want to add to that, or even some maybe dissenting views that you've heard in the circles where you are?
You want to start?
Sure. I mean, I certainly am a believer of a one-state solution. You know, our family's from South Lebanon, which means that, you know, the occupation of Israel, southern Lebanon, and was liberated in 2006 by Hezbollah. We are proponents of liberation movements, liberation militias. I believe in the right for people of occupied lands to rise up against their oppressors and occupiers by any means necessary. Thank you, France, for non.
So, and you Malcolm
know,
X.
Yeah, so Malcolm X. And, you know, so I believe in a one-state solution. I do not, like Steve had said, find it to be impossible. It was very possible and real for centuries,
for a long time.
You know, mm-hmm. And I'm not a proponent of like an Islamic state or a Christian state or a Jewish state.
Or any ethno state.
Exactly. Any ethno or religious, you know, theocracies or anything. I believe in secular governance and I think that's possible. But it's not going to be possible if they eradicate all the Palestinians from Palestine. And I do believe that Israel is on a mission to annihilate as many Palestinians as they possibly can. So there's not going to be a need for Palestinian indigeneity or indigenous lands.
To even have a discussion,
exactly. And that's what's so terrifying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been 9 months of complete and utter devastation, grotesque actions. I just watched a video of an elderly woman
being attacked,
sleeping in her bed, like in a Israeli dog with a camera on it was sicked onto her in the middle of the night, and we can watch it. You know, she's like in her 60s. You know what I mean? 70-year-old woman. This is what you know, ethno states, white supremacy, vile. I don't even know how. I don't have the words. Just grotesque governance allows to happen to the people, and I don't even know what the question is anymore because now.
I'm gonna let you have the last word here.
Okay.
What should we leave our listeners with? I know Steve reiterated the ceasefire, and that I've heard that muted over the. It was strong, but I don't hear it as much because you can't even think about next steps with bombs, you know, flying around you in rubble, trying to peel yourself off of rubble. Mm-hmm. But what do we need to remember going forward in support of Palestinian liberation, that people can then start to talk about it with other folks?
That's quite a question.
Can I just increase one little thing?
Okay.
Yes, please.
All right. Make sure Cori Bush wins her election.
Yes.
Yes. Not only for Palestinians, but for everybody. And we lost one of our supporters last night in New York with the defeat of Jamal Bowman in the Democratic primary there. And Cori Bush is the most important person in Congress in my lifetime, I think. And she's under attack from AIPAC and the Israel lobby. And anyway, I just want to leave people, especially people in St. Louis, with that. Sorry.
Okay,
sorry,
no,
Jane, I didn't want to
Steve,
there,
thank but, you so much for mentioning that. I think that that's incredibly important. And I think that if, you know, we see so much rallying around Palestine, in particular in the United States or on Turtle Island, because it's such an extremely salient demonstration of the same settler colonialism that has ravaged and perverted Turtle Island, what is now known as the United States. Yeah. And I think that's why for so many of us here, like not only Arab Americans or Arab or Black Americans, but people of African descent, Indigenous Americans of all tribes and nations, like all of us are coming together because we are seeing this, the history essentially repeat itself, right? And I'm not sure. I don't know if I know what to leave us with. I think to some extent I want to say resistance. Yeah. I want to leave us all with, you know, a sense, like a rejuvenation, a renewal of our resistance in our personal lives, in our professional lives, in our political lives. I think these are all intertwined. And so find your community, figure out what you are good at, do it loud, do it proud, do it unapologetically, because as Ahnan mentioned earlier, you know, it is a fascist, we are living in a fascist state, we're living in a fascist time. It's no matter how much we ramp up our resistance, we will be met with the same or same level of oppression, and we have to sustain our ability to resist.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
Yeah, I think the lasting thing is to be in community with people with like ideas so that you can get the reinforcement you need to keep going back out, whether it's supporting other Palestinian people, reparations, folks in Sudan. I mean, you know, there's so many places where there are flashpoints of struggle that we need to be aware of. I just want to thank my guests today. I mean, it's been amazing having this conversation, and it really can't end here just because we are out of time. It has to continue. Again, if you missed it or you came in late or you want to review this, you can always go to JamalaRogers.com and see past radio programs. But this definitely has been illuminating. And I think what I'm going to ask you for, not now because we're out of time, but what other media outlets can we be looking at for some real news, not fake news, about what's going on in that region? So I'll ask you to give that to me in an email form and share that with listeners. But I want to leave you today with the fact that, again, as we started out, this is Black Music Month. We're going to end June with a concert by UV Hayes and her band on June 30th over there at the Loop, in the Loop. And if you don't, that name doesn't sound familiar, that is none other than Bertie Hayes' lovely and talented wife. So this is a good time. I mean, it's so much mess going on that, you know, if you need a relief, come over there, listen to UV and have a couple of drinks and just chill. But it's gonna escalate, y'all. There ain't no doubt in my mind it's escalation in the future. So this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and I'll see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.
No procrastination.
Right now, we've got to do the right thing.
We've got to do it right.